Hey everyone, I wanted to hop on and just give a quick introduction and bit of context to today's episode. It's actually an episode that I recorded almost a year ago to the day, and this is an episode that actually I recorded before I even officially released the podcast, and it's an episode that delves into the Nixxiom cult as portrayed on both the HBO docuseries The Vow and also the second docuseries, which aired on Stars, called Seduced. And that particular docuseries was told specifically through the point of view of India Oxenberg and her journey with Nixxiom. I'm not really sure why I never ended up releasing this. I think it had to do with the fact that by the time I officially dropped my podcast, certainly The Vow had been off the air for a minute and people weren't really talking as much about Nixxiom as much as they had been. Also, I started the podcast off with a bunch of episodes about the Housewives, and I think I just kind of hit the ground running with that. And on that note, this episode has really been nagging on my consciousness lately, I think because I think of everything that's going on The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. And that one of the major storylines, of course, is about Mary and her church and whether it's a cult. So I think in a lot of ways, it felt like a really appropriate time to revisit this notion of cults and the themes and the issues that get presented when we're exploring this notion of a cult. And if we're to truly learn the lessons that are to be learned from how does something happen like this in the first place, how do we let ourselves get here, both as a culture? How do we let ourselves get to a place where cults are able to thrive? And also as individuals who maybe participate in cults, how do we let ourselves go so far down this road before we realize something's wrong? I think what's required is a deeper, more nuanced look than the common narrative that's placed on it. And I feel so passionately about this. And that was really the impulse and the impetus behind this conversation. So I hope you guys enjoy it. Let me know what you think. I'm always blown away by what you guys bring to the conversation when you message me with your own thoughts and insights, and I will see you on the flip side.
Hi, and welcome to Deep Dive with Jamie Stein, where we take a deep dive look at all things reality TV, pop culture, and the world at large. I'm an intuitive and an empath, which means I pick up on the thoughts, feelings, and energy percolating in other people and the world around me. I believe there is meaning waiting to be found at every turn if you're willing to see it. So join me as we dismantle everything from trash TV to high spiritual concepts and learn more about ourselves, each other, and how we're all connected.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Deep Dive with Jamie Stein. I am really excited for today's episode where we are going to deep dive the Nixxiom cult. A lot of people have been watching HBO's The Vow, which details the rise and fall of Keith Raniere and his sex cult, Nixxiom. And then there's also been another docuseries on Stars called Seduced, charting the journey of Nixxiom. And so it felt like the right time and opportunity to take a deep dive into both these TV shows and I think really explore what creates a cult and what makes people susceptible to a cult and the larger culture that makes cults possible, so that we can kind of really see like what is it that's at play here as we navigate our own lives and come up against systems of power and how we defer power and how we give away our own power and anything that invests other people with control over us that ultimately might be detrimental or harmful. So with that said, I've got two amazing guests here with me to take the plunge. If you are a follower of this podcast, you already know my first guest, my brilliant friend and colleague, Piper Sample. Hi, Piper.
Hi, Jamie.
How are you today, Piper?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
And my second guest, who is first time appearing on this podcast, hopefully not the last, is someone with a very, I think, a very interesting and special point of view into everything that we're going to talk about today. Her name is Anne Bradney, and Anne has created a form of work called Radical Aliveness, which is it's a school, it's an institute, it's a leadership program, it's a training program. It grew out of a therapeutic modality called Core Energetics. And, you know, many people often actually ask me, where were you trained? And my answer is Radical Aliveness. I am someone who went through Anne's program. It's a 4-year training program. It's actually the first 2 years as a personal transformation program. And then if you stay on for the subsequent 2 years for the full total of 4, it becomes a 4-year professional training program and you leave certified in Radical Aliveness. It's powerful work. It changed my life. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing currently without it. People travel all over from the world to work with Anne. She not only created this work, but she's an incredibly skilled facilitator. She runs huge group workshops in addition to her training program. You know, she is someone who's out there, much like a Keith Raniere, who is offering a program that invites people into personal transformation, that is definitely talking about world change. And so I thought, who better to speak to the issues brought up in shows like The Vow and Seduced than the one and only Anne Bradney. So with that said, hi, Anne.
Hi, Jamie.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited to be here. I feel like this is a really important conversation for the world right now. And it's so good to be with you and Piper, who I've worked with for so many years and who have been leaders of this work. So I'm excited.
Whenever I think about the two shows, I think the chief question that I come back to and that I hear other people asking out there in the collective is basically, you know, how does someone end up kind of falling prey to a cult like this? I think especially when you think about someone like, for example, Mark Vicente, who, you know, he was a successful guy, you know, when this came along. Like, this wasn't just some transient on the edge of society who, like, desperately needed to believe in something. I mean, he had a lot of success with his documentary, What the Bleep Do We Know? Presumably, you know, given that he had created this very kind of what was really like a benchmark in the psycho-spiritual community. He was like a smart guy, an educated guy. And even someone like Sarah Edmondson, who may not have had his level of success. I mean, when you see her and experience her on TV, this is clearly like a driven, articulate, intelligent woman. These are not necessarily what we think of as just kind of like easily impressionable, like wayward people who, you know, we could sort of easily explain why they would fall victim to a man like Keith Raniere. And so, yeah, it does kind of beg the question, what is it in someone or in the culture that makes powerful, intelligent, in some cases, even successful people succumb, you know, or find something attractive here where they do get seduced deeper and deeper down a rabbit hole?
I was thinking about how we were talking about good, bad, right, wrong, and how easy it is to look at something like this organization that Keith had and just say it's all bad, you know, when you see the final outcome. But it really looked like there was a lot that was being offered that was really interesting or that was helpful, or, you know, people got drawn in and were receiving things that were helping them. And I think that I want to start by saying that it's important, I think, not to look at something simply as, you know, bad or wrong, but that there was interesting stuff happening. And I think the other thing that feels really important is that when I look at Sarah, when I look at Mark, people were made special. They were made to feel like they were special. And for me, there's something that happens when people haven't been in their own power, mm-hmm. where being given power by a leader or being made special, being made to feel like you're special to that person, is really seductive for people.
And I would say too that maybe even before that happens, we're seekers. You know, if we're in a form where we're grappling with our limitations of being in a physical body and having like so much more all the time. And there's so many ways to explore that. And I think what was being offered was an opportunity to explore limitations, to really explore how we hold our limitations, how we maybe overcome our limitations. And there was something in this program or this offering that helped them with their own limitations. And then from that, I think they did actually feel maybe a more of a flow, so to speak, in terms of what they could follow, what they could move out. But again, this, what Anne just said, I think that's something also that gets sort of crossed along the way, is at the same time that you're coming to maybe more a sense of empowerment, this idea that the person that is teaching you this empowerment or the program or the thing that's offering you a way to look at it is the thing as opposed to the empowerment in itself. So I think something gets missed there.
Right. It's the thing as opposed to the vehicle for connecting to the thing that's inside you, which is so interesting, right? Because it, I mean, there's so many things I'm already hearing, so I just kind of want to keep track of them in my head. But even as we're being empowered as human beings, there's still something in us that then continues to want to defer power to the thing or to the person outside of us. It's like, don't let me navigate this as, oh, here, you know, here's this program, Nixium, that's connecting me to a sense of deeper power within myself that I then get to go and use and wield and feel for myself in the way that's right for me. Instead, this experience of power and bursting through limitations, I'm going to defer my power and disown my power by making it conditional on this program, which is so interesting, right? It's so interesting that there's this split. It's like, as I'm experiencing a deeper sense of power, I'm now going to disown my own power more deeply by making it conditional on Keith and Nixium. And I guess my question is, what do you think that is? Like, what is that in us that splits away from our power even as we're having a deeper experience of it? And I guess as I'm saying that, like, the question that comes to me is, like, what is our fear as individuals and as a collective of taking responsibility for our own power?
I can, like, there was a very specific moment that I won't forget in this process or this, you know, documentary, where Mark was being doing an EM or whatever those, I can't remember what they called the things that Keith would do with them, where he specifically says something related to this, where he is afraid to hurt others. He has a fear of hurting others. So there was something that happened in that moment that I went, okay, I related to that. Like, my deeper fear, if I feel my drive, my deepest fear is that I'm going to inadvertently hurt someone. I don't know if that's everyone, you know, I don't think it is. I think different people hold it in different ways. That just happens to be my brand of fear.
I feel like, first of all, from the perspective of the leader, you know, how much people want to give me power. And how constantly people are handing it over. And I feel like there's something that happens when we are empowered, or when we stop looking for someone to be above us or to have the answers, that, you know, I would just call becoming adult. And I think that there's an incredible loss there for people. I think it's easier and really seductive for people to keep believing that there is someone out there who has answers that will, they won't have to take another step. Mm-hmm. And I can remember for myself going through a process where I really had given my power away, and it was hurtful, harmful, all sorts of stuff happened for me. And in the work I did in reclaiming it, which, you know, I think I could talk a lot about, but just the incredible grief I felt when I realized that there was no one that had the answers for me. And it was kind of a sense of loneliness or aloneness that I had to give something up, some illusion from a child place that said, you know, everything will be okay because this person will tell me what to do. And then I think from that place, we're really in such a deep place of the unknown, not knowing, having to take responsibility, having to navigate a really complex world, having to navigate hurting people, taking responsibility, having our blind spots be seen. I think there's a lot that we have to kind of face if we give up that simplistic understanding of ourselves and power and other people.
Yeah, and then connected to that, what I hear, I mean, I hear two things. One, I mean, certainly there's just such a surrender in that place because you really are, in a way, giving up the notion of false idols and, you know, a dogma or a person that's going to come in and sort of tell you this is how you do it and this is the right way and you're sort of good for doing it this way. So like you said, there's the willingness to be in the unknown, which, you know, I'll take an additional step. I mean, for me, in my own perspective, as someone who feels a deep sense of spirituality, that feels like a spiritual process of like, okay, I'm walking with something that's sort of bigger and greater than me, you know, and I just sort of have to trust that I'm taken care of here. And I think the second thing, which feels very connected to that too, is I also have to trust and know my own good intentions. Because like you're saying, Anne, it's like, I might hurt people and my own blind spots might get exposed. Like, this is a place where I'm not in control, you know, in the unknown, none of us are in control. So if there's a place in me where I question my own good intentions, where I question my own goodness, where I hold my own humanity against myself, I can imagine I'm not going to want to claim the full ownership of my power and surrender to that unknown place, because there's some part of me that's kind of like hanging out in the shadows saying like, I don't want this scene. I don't want that scene. If people find out this about me, then I'm going to be exposed. And like I said, it just feels like in that place, there is sort of just a lack of fundamental trust and like, I'm okay. Again, both from without in terms of my journey in the world and also from within. Like, I trust myself here and I'm safe and good enough to be willing to claim my seat at the table and to walk into the unknown without like Keith Raniere's permission or mom's permission or dad's permission or, you know, whomever. And that, yeah, I can hurt people. I can make mistakes and I can sit here and say, yes, I did that and I'm sorry. And now what?
And I was thinking there's one more thing that I just want to throw in here because I think it's a really important piece, is that at least in this culture, you know, in the West, it's such an individualistic culture and we're really taught that everything is about us or we have all this power to create the world. There's so little community, I think. And so much loneliness and aloneness, and people want to belong. So when they get involved in an organization where there's this great feeling and fun and connection, and then speaking up might, or seeing things or knowing things might threaten their belonging. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important place. And it goes back to what I was saying before. I think there's some place where the aloneness, like facing the fact that ultimately we are alone, or being able to tolerate that feeling in ourselves is what gives us the strength to be able to speak up, even if it means we're going to be banished.
I think in terms of another driving force of what attracts people to communities in general has to do with that type of connection. And then in terms of a cult, the leadership, the way that the leadership holds those voices that are coming out and saying, hey, this is something that I have a question around or doesn't feel right, when it gets met with, there's something wrong with you to overcome in order to stay and belong here, then that, if that belief that you walked into the community with gets activated there, then the belief is there is something wrong with me. I'm going to take in what this person knows that I don't know and keep working to be better, to not be wrong in order to stay. And there's that constant, again, drive to meet this limitation when maybe, maybe what you're saying is actually important. You know, like one of my favorite characters in this whole sort of Nexium thing was Bonnie. You know, like she, there was a certain way that I felt her where, you know, what she was attracted to was the integration process of all, you know, all these EMs. You know, she was like, she was saying something about like, I was really attracted to the integrating. And for me, I felt her integrating this information that helped her see first what the hell was going on. Like, wait, he's using something against me here. And she kept kind of challenging, they showed a lot of her sort of challenging him and the way that he would turn it around on her. And like when I feel that, it just makes my stomach like that. That's where I can feel myself in an organization. If I ever got met that way, that would be my cue.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that because it's like that was one place where I actually identified with the, you know, the people who were seduced into Nexium. Not now, but there's definitely a time in my life where I was definitely conditioned to just always assume that I was doing the wrong thing and I was in my own way and just constantly feeling like I was my own worst enemy. And there were just so many fundamental things I had to change about myself. And so I could really see being in an organization where if I were speaking up and saying, hey, like, this is my fear, this is my concern, and then there was a voice saying, actually, like, this fear and this concern is a symptom of the thing that's holding you back, and this is your opportunity to challenge yourself. I could really see myself at a certain point in my life, like, taking that in and thinking, oh, they're right. I don't know. I guess I'm just saying that because it's also just such an interesting line for me, because obviously, in the case of Nexium, I think that's a line that was obviously being abused. And I also could sort of imagine, I mean, this exists out there, like, you know, I mean, sort of programs that seek to challenge you, like, you know, get out of your comfort zone for this, you know, going on a vision quest, you know, for the sake of healthy challenge. And it's like, how does one even navigate that line of healthy challenge, busting out of my comfort zone, finding my own blind spots versus no, wait, there's like a voice of wisdom and intuition inside me right now that's saying, no, like, this isn't right for me.
I think, you know, when you were asking what's a sign of a cult, for me, there's something about the leader not being able to be challenged. Like, if you can't challenge the leader, if the leader is being held as someone with superhuman wisdom that puts the leader above everyone else, and that the leader himself or herself says that's true, I happen to be a genius and I have all the answers, leave, turn around and run the other direction as fast as you can. And so for me, there's something about, again, that place where I just want to say to anybody who's listening, yeah, somebody might have more experience than you. They might be older than you. They might have done a lot of work. They might have a lot of skills. But if you're not willing to understand that you know, we're all human beings, and that leaders are fallible, have blind spots, make mistakes, cannot have all the answers. If you're not willing to see that, you're going to end up in trouble. And if you're with a leader who's saying that that's who they are, that they're not capable of making mistakes, or the way they frame making mistakes isn't really about owning them or being willing to hear feedback and grow, I think that's a sign of a cult, that the leader cannot be challenged or questioned.
And I think also, just to kind of in some ways answer my own question, it's also the assumption, like if I'm someone who, you know, is navigating this question of like, well, am I just in my resistance or am I in my fear? And what is this? It's also holding the possibility that, let's just say for a moment, I am in a blind spot. Maybe my fear and resistance is overtaking me. And maybe the best thing for my process right now is for me to follow that impulse and to say no, and then to see what happens, and then to learn a lesson. And then I get information for myself about, so this is sort of what it feels and looks like when I'm in my resistance versus my wisdom. And it's the idea that my no can still, even if it is a blind spot, it can still take me somewhere, and it can still take me to a place of deeper learning. And so it's like, if I trust that there is no wrong answer, and then I think to kind of speak to what you're saying, and so if I'm coming up against a voice of authority that is putting pressure on me to do it a certain way and isn't really giving me space or freedom to explore what it is I need to explore and to follow my different impulses and to try on, yeah, different forms of output of energy, I think that's a pretty strong sign that something's off too. Like, I should feel like there's agency here for me to make a choice and to see where it goes, and that I am absolutely allowed to make mistakes because I can learn from those mistakes. And then, like I said, just even as an individual who's navigating my own spiritual process, I just feel like that feels like an important principle, you know, for anyone listening, just this notion of like, in the place where we're living these lives and we're trying things on and we're constantly in the wild of our lives and learning lessons, as banal as it might sound, there truly is no mistake. There's simply choice, and you're always going to learn from whatever the choice is. So I guess I'm saying this because I have to imagine for a lot of people that pressure they might feel from a Keith Raniere or from like a yoga guru or whomever, I have to imagine it lands because it's an externalization of the pressure they're already placing on themselves. And so it's like, if we can even relieve some of the pressure inside of ourselves by giving ourselves freedom of choice and freedom to make mistakes and freedom to learn in many different ways, I have to imagine it's going to make us less susceptible to betraying ourselves in a way that doesn't feel good when we're faced with that kind of thing.
Yeah, and to be supported in that process might look a lot different if your support is able to sit with you in the discomfort of resistance, or really be with you in that process that allows you the discovery that you are there to have in a supported way, not in a way where you're counting on the other to change you, but to be reflecting back, you know, whatever it is they're in contact with related to your experience, but validating your experience first. Because this has been my experience anyway. There's lots of paths of, I guess, challenging our own limitations. We can do it on our own, and we can do it with others. And if we choose to engage with others in that process, I think it's really important to recognize whether or not the helpers that you have around you are willing to see you and be with you as you are, where you are, why you are there, where it comes from, everything that you need to know about that moment in time that you're in, as opposed to just saying, stop doing that, do this other thing, and heights, you know, will be reached. I think in choosing support, in choosing accompaniment for exploring your own inner world and your limitations, I think recognizing if the person or people around you are able to see you and your experience from where you are now would be maybe a good question, because I think a lot of times people feel misunderstood when they do speak out, when they do bring something out that says, this doesn't work for me. And then all this information comes back. Well, it's not working because you're doing this, or, you know, like they're not like, okay, it's not working. What's that like when it's not working? What, you know, there's something about maybe more of a cultish or a, and I don't even think this is just related to cults. I think I see it related to promises. If you do step 1, 2, and 3, your experience will be success. There's a formula. There's so much more complexity around the process that doesn't take into account the individual and how they see the world. There's something about that that feels limiting in itself.
Yeah, I mean, as you speak, what I become aware of, it's just that forceful push of like a linear path. You know, it's like, if you do this, then this, or these are the heights that are promised. And that was one of the things that did really jump out to me watching The Vow as what I would call a huge red flag of Keith Raniere promising like a life of constant joy. And it just, I mean, yeah, it is laughable. I mean, it to me, it's so like, for this man to be this kind of like evil mastermind genius, and literally he's promising something as just sort of banal and sort of unrealistic as like, oh, you're going to be in constant joy. You know, it has that same flavor of a push. It's like, you know, it's this linear push towards this like lofty goal. I'm going to be in joy. I'm going to be in joy. I'm reaching for something. I'm gripping something. I'm always going to be in joy. And to me, there is kind of such a forceful quality to that, rather than like what you're saying, Piper, the energy of surrender, the energy of being willing to sit with what is, even if it is my resistance, even if it is feeling like in this instance, like a square peg in a round hole. And then, yeah, like, am I willing to drop the need or demand to be somewhere or anywhere else and kind of hang out here, you know, hopefully with support, and get information from this place about, yeah, what is there to learn about myself? What is there to learn about the world here? Rather than kind of striving for some sort of lofty, I mean, it's literally like, you know, like Dorothy trying to find her way home. Like, there's this one goal and we're just walking the yellow brick road to it. I mean, and then it's like, what happens then when you get it? You know, it's like all these people just sitting around in joy for the rest of their lives.
I think that's the place about certainty, right? I mean, that we keep talking about, like, people who are holding a process as having a certain outcome or certain answers, and people wanting certainty, wanting to know that they're going to do something and get somewhere. Feels to me that thing you were talking about, Jamie, about having everything turned back on you. So if you bring a criticism, it comes back to, you know, what aren't you seeing in yourself, which is such a mind fuck. And for me, it's like, in that setup, there's an invisible power structure. When everything is held in psychological terms without knowing that there is also a systemic reality, there's a program, there are human beings running the program, there are agreements, there's a reality besides what's going on psychologically. And if that's not named, or if that's made invisible, then it's really easy for a leader to keep making anything you're saying about reality turn back on yourself as if it's your problem. And I think it's really interesting that most of the people in this program seem to be upper middle class socialized as white people. You know, like, who was in that program, and who is the system invisible to the people who are part of the norm? So I thought that was really interesting. And I think that's also a sign of danger, you know, or cult, if the system itself is not visible and cannot be questioned.
And not recognizing itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that I also wanted to go back to that felt important to me that you mentioned up top, Anne, you know, is the notion that there were things of value in this program. And again, like, that's a place where I saw myself possibly seduced, because I mean, truthfully, I wanted an EM watching that first episode. I was like, and even Catherine Oxenberg, like, she, you know, she said it. She was like, she had a really powerful experience. I don't know if it was, I think it was in Seduced that she talked about this, that she had an EM, she had a breakthrough, you know, and, you know, then for her, she did, I think, go to the next level. And it was at that point that she started realizing, like, okay, like, I don't really think this is for me. But even for someone like her who had a skeptical point of view and had the willingness to say no to NXTM, there was stuff that she got from this originally. And I just bring that up because I do notice in the reaction to the cult, there tends to be this desire, this tendency to really throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I really felt like I saw this amongst the deprogramming cult experts they brought in on the show, where they specifically targeted, like, this notion that, you know, we create our own realities and that everything happens for a reason. And they were sort of talking about, they sort of framed it as, like, that's spiritual mumbo jumbo that's sort of used to control and to abuse and to sort of make people feel like, you know, they're to blame for everything, and that's where you can manipulate them. Which, I want to be clear, it does feel like that's what was happening within the world of NXTM. Obviously, for me, I don't believe that about those principles in general. But I'm speaking now to, yeah, it just seems like there's this sort of backlash trend that's like, all of this is garbage, it's all a tool of manipulation. Which I then think also creates a secondary unspoken narrative of kind of like, these people are fools for falling for this in the first place. And to me, it's kind of like a real reductionist narrative that I think in some ways helps create the culture that makes people susceptible to cults, because it's like Piper said, these are seekers. They're looking for something. And I think it is important to name and acknowledge and to say, and there was something here. Like, Keith Raniere did create at least some things that felt like they had actual constructive power.
And Keith and Nancy.
And Nancy, yes. And there's
the unspoken architect of the entire program.
Let's not forget Nancy.
And we can get into Nancy. But the last thing I was just going to say, though, is, like, I don't know, there's just something about naming that. And I think there's something that I feel about, like, people's in the collective's fear to acknowledge there may have been some good stuff here. And what happens if we let ourselves acknowledge that? Because, again, it comes back to this. That's what I mean when I say it creates the culture that makes susceptible to this in the first place. It's binary thinking. It's like,
yes,
good, bad, right, wrong.
Yes.
And in this place, exactly, though, it's everyone else looking at this, be like, oh, that's totally wrong.
It seems like just the flip side of the same frame, right? It's like Keith is, you know, on, and the cult is in one place, and then the people against it are just, they're doing the exact same thing from the other perspective of saying, no, I'm right, and this was wrong. And there's something so not complex about it, and so not nuanced, and so not willing to be with how complicated the world is.
Which is, again, like, this is where it directly links around politics, you know, today too. It's so clearly seen that if I'm on the right side of things, the other side is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, that's it. And if I see that something is wrong, and I'm doing air quotes here, over there, I have to stay away from that. I have to not see what is potentially true and real in that, because, you know, I would be susceptible to having to take responsibility for how I hold the complexity of life. It's easier in some ways just to make a boogeyman over there and to feel right over here. And anytime those two things get close together internally, that's actually where we, I think, get to grow. I love personally the middle, and I get really agitated myself when there is this binary kind of conversation going on, because it feels like there's no opportunity other than the opportunity to get stronger in
your belief, rightness,
your rightness, or, you know, really keep pointing, finding evidence as to what makes that bad over there. And when you're looking out from your rightness, everything that doesn't sync up here is going to be bad. So then that becomes the perspective of the binary, is keep that over there. Don't let it get near me, because it's going to, I mean, and I see this in religions. I see this, you know, with people that hold certain beliefs and doctrines. It's like, I can't even let the entertainment of something outside of my perspective near me, because I might get infected, or I might, you know, the fear is truly that they will be swayed to this other dark side, as if they don't have the responsibility to go, oh, you know, no, I'm good. I'm over here. I can take in your perspective, and this is my value, or this is my belief. There's something that happens right there in this binary position that, but really apparent here in North America at this particular time.
And you're speaking now to this experience of like, what if I'm kind of in my position of like, I'm right, you're wrong, the resistance to even surrendering to a space of like, well, let me just check out what's going on over there. Is that what you're speaking to specifically?
Yeah. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I mean, I've heard this rhetoric lately of, if this is what I see happening, I know that I'm right. This is the evidence that says I'm right. And I don't have to make room for anything other than that. And I'm going to cut you off over there, because I will not be associated. I will not surround myself with people that are doing these things that are, for me, wrong.
And just to kind of be specific, like, meaning in terms of current events, like, I see people wearing sort of neo-Nazi clothes, storming the Capitol, threatening harm. That is clearly wrong behavior. And that's my evidence that they are clearly wrong, and they are different from me, and I'm on the right side of history.
And I don't want to know anything more about that.
Yeah, so if we followed that for a moment, Piper, can you even energetically model what would it mean or look like for, because, you know, I'm sure there are people listening to this who this is landing, like, that is their point of view. It's like they see this behavior, and of course the behavior is destructive, right? And so it's easy to understand how and why someone would look at that and say, like, there are wrong things going on over there, and I don't stand for that, and that is an other. I'm just curious, sort of, what would you say to that person about, like, the spirit of the willingness to not other them, like, still obviously being in awareness and ownership that there are destructive actions being taken, right? They are wearing this Nazi like regalia, and yet still not shutting them out completely and seeing what might be over there for me. Like, what does that mean to you?
What I might feel is a no. No to the behavior, no to what's happening, no to destruction, no to overpowering other people. Like, no, just slow down. Something like, slow down, like, stop acting, doing what you're doing. I'll stop acting, doing what we're doing. Let's just pause and take a moment. And what's happening, you know, like, energetically, what I, like, if I saw this as a process, you know, in our context, in the radical aliveness field, for instance. Of course, when people have guns and weapons, and it's not a container that's like kind of being held that says, we have these agreements that you're not going to hurt each other. That's something that's different out in the real world. People have weapons. They're choosing to create harm. So it's a little different, I think, in that context. There's a different way of holding it, I guess. But ultimately, it would be, I imagine creating energetically a way for things to slow down, because there's something frenzied about the fear and the back and forth. And it's like to sort of create a little more space for a recognition of what is actually happening. The way I see it or feel it, there's so much fear. And the fear takes over, and then the action is coming from fear. And the question would be, what are you afraid of?
the question for the people who are storming the Capitol, or the question for the people who are listening? Yeah, or both.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm on the side where I'm saying I need to open up to something, not to create this binary narrative, I would need to know something more about the other, but also hold on to this no that's in myself. Like, this is mine. No, I don't stand for this. I stand for something else.
Right. And understanding that both those things can be true at once. Like, I'm allowed to have my boundary. I'm allowed to have my no. I'm allowed to have the place inside that me that says these things aren't okay. And at the same time, I can also want you held responsible for any destructive actions that you're taking. And at the same time, I can also choose not to other you, not to demonize you, and to, like, for example, what you're saying, get curious about what are you afraid of? Like, where is this coming from inside you? What is the unmet need? Like, what's actually going on here, rather than, like, making fun of how you look, dismissing you as, like, a fascist, and that's that.
Othering you. And I would say one more small piece here. I'm talking about me, who grew up in the United States. This is the way I would hold it because of who I am and because of my experience that I've had. So if I'm standing next to a sister or a brother in color, I would not expect them to have the same type of interest or tolerance or anything really there. Even somebody else that looks just like me or grew up right next door to me, like, they may hold this in a completely different way. And if I'm standing in a room full of people that are holding this and all those, I'm also looking to the people I'm standing with and saying, what's happening for you guys here too? What's happening over here? Like, what is happening? But I think there's something about the slowing of things down that doesn't always, it's not easy.
The voice I hear in the collective, like in response to you, Piper, the fear is kind of like, my fear is if I slow down enough to hear someone else, that means it comes at the expense of my voice. I'm going to get trampled on. I'm going to get killed. It's kill or be killed. And in order for my voice to be heard, your voice has to be stomped out, either or.
Yeah. And then there might be a place where I have to be willing to be quiet, you know, to invite more space for that voice to be heard, because I can't hear you with all this violence.
No, I'm really kind of feeling into all of this because it feels so complex, you know? There's so much here. It's like, first, the idea that you can just stomp something out or make it go away. You can't. So, I mean, that's what I think about radical aliveness. Why we want to say yes to everything is because all of this stuff has energy and it's life behind it. And if it's just suppressed, or it's made politically correct, or people are made to say and do only the right things in certain ways, it goes underground in ways that I think just keep the whole thing going forever. So for me, I'm really interested in I would say for myself, you can't look at 70 million people and say they're all idiots, or they're all bad, or they're all this, or they're all that. It's kind of like looking at Nexium and just saying it's bad. And this way that we want to not, kind of like what Piper's saying, be open to, you know, people can make really bad decisions. And who's the guy, Brian Stevenson, who wrote the book Just Mercy, says, mm-hmm. people are more than their worst action. Mm-hmm. And so we're not born hating each other. This is Martin Luther King's birthday we're talking on. You know, we're not born hating each other. We don't grow up learning. We don't get born othering others. We get taught that. And then what do we need to do inside ourselves to, yeah, like Piper's saying, invite in the willingness to find out, who are you? What are you saying? why, and it sounds simplistic on one level, because I know, yes, I'm very privileged. My life is not being threatened on a daily basis when I go outside. So I don't want to sound naive. I really don't mean to be naive. But I think, how do I, for instance, me and Bradley, I've reached out to people who hold very different perspectives from mine and said, I want to know more. Tell me what you're thinking. Tell me why you believe this. Tell me, like, I'm having ongoing conversations because I feel like in my position, that's something I can do. And I want to be open to knowing more and ultimately being able to, you know, my goal is that people will be together, at least people who are seekers coming from very radically different perspectives. And that if we can hold people in a certain way without shaming them or making them wrong or bad, that there's an opportunity for us to have a profound influence on each other by being willing to hear each other's stories, by being willing to know more about why we believe or feel the things we do.
Also being willing, because Jamie, you brought something up that I think is really important. There's the stomping out in the way I sense it or feel it has something to do with this lack of being heard or listened to by what they're trying to stomp out. So to me, that's an act of trying to create some space, you know, like this is my version of trying to do that if I'm the one who's doing that. And that's the only thing that I have available to me, or, you know, that I recognize gets responded to. So if that's the act that comes first, and I guess that's kind of the way I see it from, again, my perspective, where I have a general sense of safety and like I haven't had violence against me time and time and time again. I have a little more tolerance or room for it because it doesn't live in me the same way. So maybe the person next to me who has been violated over and over again, when that movement comes, their response to that is definitely not, I'm going to stomp that out. That's where I think what Anne is saying, it gets so complex in terms of group behavior, because the groups have a complexity to them, a different way, a different place that they're coming from. And then in a group dynamic, whatever the largest sort of energetic expression is, it kind of gets couched into that is the only thing that's happening here.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is just violent, or this is just destructive. Okay. There's some violence and there's some destructive living in these beings. Where did that come from? Why is it expressing itself now? What's the intention? Is it working? These are the questions, I think, that in heated experiences, there's not a lot of room for that. If somebody's life is being extinguished based on these actions, it's a lot harder for me to stand there and go, oh, why are you doing this? First, it's no. That's not a value of mine to witness somebody's life being taken.
Right. I mean, it almost feels like different levels of consciousness to me. It's like, you know, you're speaking to what to me sounds like a time and a place where the strong no is needed. It's like, this is what's needed right now. But I think the idea being that, you know, going back to what Anne's saying, it's true. It's like energy. You can't destroy energy. So an impulse is coming from somewhere. So at some point, if we are to quote unquote heal this, there is going to have to be space made to slow down and find out, yeah, where is this violent force coming from? And it's just so interesting because it's like, you know, there's so much talk about like what happens on social media. And more and more, I just see it so much. It's such a crystal clear microcosm of like the energetic patterns of what's happening. Because I literally, so I was on Facebook the other night, and you know, there's that satirist JP Sears who like makes all those videos, and I guess he's really sort of come out lately with like a real, I guess what I would call right-wing bent. But he recently posted this meme that basically said something like, if someone thinks differently than you, do the compassionate thing and treat them with contempt and hostility. You know, which was basically poking fun at like the self-righteousness of the left, which, you know, I think that's there's wisdom in that, right? But then to see the comments, you know, mostly his followers, you know, most of whom have kind of like what I would call like a right-wing bent, or, you know, they're leaning that way, going through insulting the left, like, you know, hostility, contempt. And I'm just sitting there looking. And then there are a few lone voices, you know, people who are kind of saying what I was experiencing, which is like, wait a second, you're sitting there pointing a finger at the other side for kind of self-righteously being on a high horse, but then treating you with intolerance while they're on a high horse. And yet, literally, that's what's going on here in the comments. Like, you guys are now on a high horse, looking at the left, treating them with hostility and contempt. And when those people spoke up, guess what happened? There was just more hostility and contempt, right? But to like also put this to the other side, you know, obviously I'm someone, I consider myself progressive and liberal, whatever those words mean. That's, you know, the large part of my community. And I've witnessed Facebook friends getting online saying something like, basically, if you disagree with me on this, or if you're this way, like, we're done, we're not friends. And then there's a comment section where everyone's agreeing, and literally there'll be like one or two lone voices. I mean, these poor souls, it's like, I just want to be like, why are you even trying? But there'll be these one or two lone voices being like, hey, like, I have a different viewpoint, and like, isn't that okay? It is like Lord of the Flies. It is like Lord of the Flies. I mean, it's actually disturbing to me. But the reason why I'm saying this, I'm like, it's happening on both sides. Both sides think they have this moral high ground. Both sides are pointing the finger at the other side saying, like, you're intolerant. And I guess the reason why I'm saying this, it's like, it almost to me does become a spiritual conversation, or a conversation around just like principles of energy, because it's like, you are only going to continue to create what you're currently creating. So going back to what you were saying, Piper, if there is a voice that's saying, I need space, and the only way I know how to get it is to stomp out the other side, or if my need for space is manifesting itself in a form of like, I'm going to stomp you out so I have space. Unfortunately, I believe what that means is we are going to just stay stuck in a cycle where everyone's trying to stomp the other one out. Just like right now, if I'm sitting here trying to point a finger at you, trying to point out how you're like a self-righteous hypocrite because you're on a high horse, and meanwhile, you're treating me with hostility and contempt. Well, guess what? That's the cycle we're going to be locked in forevermore, until someone is willing to kind of step aside, pause, breathe, and give someone else the space, in the spirit of, it will create space for us all, ultimately.
I think there's something, I feel like we have this theme going from beginning, like there's something here that feels like such a theme that starts out with the vow and starts out with Keith Raniere and then goes out to the world. But there's, it, for me, it goes back to that place of the people wanting to believe like that the world is more simple than it is, that there are answers, simple answers. This is right. This is wrong. This is right. This is wrong. And we can live that way. And then I never have to look at my own participation. I never have to grow up. I never have to be responsible for the places in me that might be harming other people. Yes, I find social media really takes advantage of that place in human beings and is amplifying it. Like, is amplifying the simplistic way of thinking. And for me, it just seems so toxic and so dangerous in all directions, because I rarely see something complex going on social media. I go on and I think, why are people even doing this? It just feels like a screaming match. And I don't think it's a place where things are getting resolved or solved. I feel like it's a place where something that needs to shift is not even getting a chance to be felt. It's just getting reinforced and reinforced and reinforced, like the binary thinking. It just keeps everybody in this level of the triggering and the fear, the defense, where it's just like ongoing, staying there, reinforcing it. Nobody ever has to drop or feel anything other than rage and outrage.
By its very design, it's all about quick hits. You go on, you scroll, you get the quick hit. Okay, I'm going to offer my quick hit. So it energetically is antithetical to the very idea of like slowing down, dropping in, like feeling the subtlety, feeling the complexity. It's literally designed to be sort of a fast dopamine hit, which, yeah, totally like plays into the culture and energy of fear.
Well, it reflects our culture. I mean, true. That's what I've seen. It's like we're a disconnected culture that acts in sound bites, that doesn't drop in and feel our complexity, our vulnerability, our deep fears, our deepest sense of purpose and meaning in relationship to the people that surround us.
Although I think we're at a tipping point. And the irony here, or maybe the non-binary richness, is I think social media, the internet, and the availability of information is a vehicle for part of what is facilitating the tipping point, because there is communication happening and ideas being exchanged that weren't so easily exchanged previously.
You know, I was thinking, Jamie, I remember that you said you wanted people to walk away with some tools or some information. And I was thinking about the three of us having a conversation about what it's like to receive criticism, feedback, challenge, to be challenged in our blind spots. For me, like I will say, as a leader, you know, with a holding kind of, I have at times held a large organization with a lot of voices. And, you know, I'm human. I do my best. I'm sure there are places that I've, you know, not done well with it. I've thought at times, why leaders would want to be the kind of leaders who say, I have the answers and here are the rules, and just, you know, kind of staying in the expert model of, because it protects you from having to feel all this stuff that's coming at you all the time. What happens when people really challenge the shit out of you or tell you you're not seeing them? Or what does it take to be able to stay and receive that kind of feedback and hopefully hear people's voices, expand your perspective, weigh the places where you can feel yourself, but maybe there's something you're not seeing? I think it's a very important thing to talk about, because it's what we're talking about people needing to be able to do.
Well, let me ask you, Anne, since you're bringing that up, I mean, you did have the experience, right, early on of someone going online and basically saying, this was like in the school's infancy, like, this is a cult. Radical aliveness is a cult.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, you know, since we are talking about cults and, you know, you're bringing in kind of the role of the leader, what was that experience like for you? And how do you, as a leader who doesn't want to just deflect criticism, wants to stay open, and also wants to, like, I think, be connected to what's true for you and not take on things that don't feel true to you. I mean, how do you navigate that, or how did you navigate that?
You know, that was in the very first year of the program. And I remember when I found out that this person, you know, I made so many mistakes, you know, so many mistakes through the years learning how to hold this program. But the person who wrote that was, you know, struggling. And I found out that she had put that up. And I remember being really horrified at first, like, oh, it was scary. It was like out there on the internet, people were calling me. And you know, it was hard. It was hard, but it was really like I really tried to look at what created the conditions that made her feel that way. Rather than, oh, she's wrong and bad, it was like, this is a message from the world to me about something that's going on here that I have to pay attention to. And what are the things that I need to learn here in response to something that's happening in this way in the world? And what's really interesting was I ended up talking to her later, maybe a couple years on, because I think I'm actually on a site where they'll never take it down, because the belief is that if you're asking for it to be taken down, like even if she asked for it to be taken down, the belief is that the cult might have gotten to you. So it's up there for eternity, which is okay with me. It's fine. I'm really okay with it. But there was a point where I ended up talking to her, you know, so I spent a long time really looking at what was my part in things, what did I need to learn from it, what was it telling me, and I think I did learn a lot from it, and it's not like when somebody does something like that, they're completely insane or off the deep end, you know, she was having an experience, and when she told me everything that went into putting that up there, you know, it just made sense. And so I think on my end, it's just important to be willing, whatever is happening, to receive it and to try and make meaning from it and to try and understand it and to try not to push it away as if I have no part in it. Of course I do.
Yeah, and what I love about what you're saying, I mean, this kind of goes back to the very beginning of the conversation, because what I hear, I mean, again, it's the opposite of binary thinking, and it's this space that says, okay, let me be open to whatever wisdom is here. Let me be open to whatever learning is here, and I don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I don't have to make myself wrong. I don't have to feel like I'm a failure. I don't have to believe that I'm a cult leader. I don't have to betray my own sense of my own good intentions. And at the same time, I can stay open to the wisdom that there's something going on that I need to look at. And if I'm not in my fear, and if I don't need to crush out a voice out of fear in this place, then I can slow down. And I can surrender to this experience, and I can find out, okay, what's here for this woman? And in doing so, what's actually here for me too?
Yeah. And I think for me, the thing that was most painful was that my entire intention around creating radical aliveness was around really changing a power dynamic of leadership to participants and welcoming all the voices. So it was just so ironic that right away it turned into, you know, that was the criticism coming back, and it was painful. But yeah, I'm not sorry it happened.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds perfect, actually. I mean, like, if you're sitting there saying, my whole intention is to create something that's not a cult, I mean, what a more perfect kind of invitation from the universe than right away someone saying, this is a cult. And then seeing, like, how do you navigate that, and where does that take you, and what do you need to look at there?
And I was going to say, if I'm participating in something that isn't working for me, for whatever reasons that it's not working, if I bring those reasons to a leader or to the group that I'm with, and I get a perspective that is not only mine, if I'm willing to participate in that responsibly and saying, this is what isn't working for me here. Are the conditions going to stay the same? Are they going to change? Are you willing to take me into account here in this process? If not, I can leave. But if I don't bring that in and I just keep acting as if, I might start feeling like I am not in control anymore, or I'm not in rhythm with what's actually happening inside of me. I'm starting to try to behave in a way that is outside of the way I would typically behave. Now I have to make you a cult in order to leave, maybe, or I have to make you so bad in order to leave, rather than just say, hey, this isn't what I was hoping for.
What you're saying, again, I just keep feeling the themes here of, if in the world we're trying to really shift things, on all sides, the responsibility to have the courage to bring our voice, to bring our perspective, to bring what's true for us, because that's how we're going to help things that aren't right change. Mm-hmm. And then on the receiving end, what is it we have to do to receive those voices? And I think that's the place where we stop being in that uneven power dynamic of, you're less, I have the answers, or I'm less, you know more than me. And we become really in that place where we take our responsibility for doing the hard work of saying, this isn't working, this needs to change in this way, and taking those risks to change the world, to change the systems that we're part of. And I think what you're saying that feels important to me is, what does it take on the side of someone who's part of a system to bring that voice forth?
What conditions are helpful to allow people in groups understand that what they have to bring has value, even if it is against some seemingly normative way that this operates?
Yeah.
Especially, and this is where I think the interesting aspect around ranking and power dynamics and all that kind of stuff comes in, because if I have invested into a program, I'm a participant now, and I've said, I really like what you're selling, and I'm investing what I have for you to give me this information for me. If what you're delivering doesn't make sense to me, I'm thinking already, I need to dig deeper, because this person has promised this thing, right? Like, I've already given you some sort of energetic exchange that puts you up here in some way.
Yeah.
And so somehow the framing of the environment, I think, needs to be explicit in terms of, okay, you may be investing your time, you may be investing your money into something, and let's be clear. Mm-hmm. That by you doing that, I'm not saying that I have answers for you. I'm saying that I'm going to accompany you, you know, or I don't know. I mean, different programs are held different ways. I'm just thinking in terms of the power dynamics related to programming, to teaching, to delivering information that people are giving in exchange for. There's a certain way that I think, maybe it's more of a question here, like in a cult, dynamically, how is that held in a way that's different than maybe a program like Radical Aliveness?
Well, I was just about to say, I mean, what I'm hearing on a very kind of simple, fundamental level in terms of warning signs for cults, and yes, what separates cults from other programs, it's like, if and when you are feeling a pause or a question or a no or resistance, truly, like, how is that met by the system? Is there space for it? Is there room for it? Even if they don't agree, is there space for you to have your process? Is there support for you to come to the decision that's right for you? Or is it like we've been discussing? Yeah, is it turned against you? This is actually a fault of yours. You know, if you're not going this way, then you're going to miss out on something, versus, yeah, space and room for you to get connected to yourself and what's true for you and your own wisdom. I just had a client of mine who's also seeing a therapist, and he was saying that, like, he's having this impulse. He wants to stop therapy, because I guess the therapist recently suggested he should be going twice a week rather than once a week. And he's having an impulse like that he shouldn't be going, like, he wants a break. And, you know, and he was nervous about telling the therapist and, like, kind of upsetting her. And I was kind of saying to him, like, no, you need to look at this like a test for her to see what she's made of as a therapist. I was like, if you go to her, letting her know that you're really having this impulse and you don't feel 100% support for you to make the decision that's right for you. It's not to say she can't challenge you if she's feeling something, but that ultimately the challenge is in support of you getting connected to what's right for you. That's your telltale sign. This might not be the right person to be going to.
I think that's a really important thing that you're saying is can you leave? I mean, can you leave? And can you leave without being made wrong or bad? And if somebody leaves a program or says this isn't right for me, and then everyone in the program makes them wrong and bad, or the leaders make them wrong or bad for leaving, I think, again, that's a sign that there's something really wrong. People should be able to say, this isn't right for me and I want to go. And you should be able to hear them say, this isn't right for me. And people have the right to come and go. They don't have to stay forever.
And then it's just so funny, too, because it does go both ways. For example, you mentioned that site, right, where it's like nothing can be taken down. And if people want you to take it down, it's because those are the hooks of the cult. And like the cult leaders who I are not the cult leaders, the anti-cult deprogrammers on Seduced, who kind of like want to assign it all as wrong. It is another version of what we're talking about, because I've been to some of those sites. And when some people sometimes do speak up and say, hey, actually, you know what, this is kind of another way of seeing it, or I had a different experience with this particular thing, those people come in and immediately, again, it's like Lord of the Flies. It's like pointing a finger at the person. Oh, you're brainwashed. This is a vehicle of the cults. The cults are all bad. This is the way it is. And again, the deep irony here is like, you guys have your own dogma and your own script that you're rigidly sticking to. And if someone comes in with a different viewpoint, you're not willing to tolerate it.
Yeah, I was going to say, this. It brings me back to Mark. Mark was somebody I was really thinking about, because if you've been involved in something where you've crossed your own boundaries, where you haven't seen things, where you have participated in harm, what is the process that takes you all the way through to healing on the other side? And for me, that involves a willingness to look at your own collusion all the way. What was it you didn't want to see? What was it you didn't want to feel? What do you have to take responsibility for? I feel like once Mark or Sarah or Nippy or whoever's out of it gets out, the next step is go all the way into what happened for you. Take responsibility for the places where you got something out of this. You were willing to not see things. I mean, think about Nazi Germany. Like, what does it take for human beings to take responsibility for being part of something harmful, including me, you know, in the system I'm a part of in this world? What does it take for me to have the strength internally to open my eyes and to see things so that I can actually help this world and myself and systems that are harmful change?
I would say watching the arc of this documentary series, and even in the Seduced, Seduced was a little more for me, it went into a little more about like a participant's viewpoint, which was, I think, a little more interesting. But the tone of this did leave me hoping that there will be another dive into those people that supported this, because that was kind of what I kept feeling as a person that has supported systems and is becoming more aware of the way I participate and being special in a system or benefiting from certain parts of belonging in the way that I do, and what that didn't allow me to really hold responsibility for in myself and choices that I made. I saw a few of the, you know, the methods or whatever that they use, that there was certain ways that they were opening up the body to different things. And I was like, yeah, I remember specifically participating as a leader in a way that I didn't want to.
Yeah.
That didn't feel good to me. I'd been through it as a participant before, so I know what it offered me and gave me. But I had always questioned, did I need to go through that to get here? And then being on the other side of it, where I was participating in a way that was maybe challenging someone in a way that isn't comfortable for me personally as a human being to challenge another. And I did it anyway. Mm-hmm. And what was it that allowed me to bypass? Like, I would complain about it. I would go, I don't like this, you know, and somehow I didn't just do it without saying anything. I know that I definitely said what was hard for me about it. But again, I thought something was wrong with me, that I was missing something, that I was still learning as a part of the system in this new position I was in. And I didn't like it. It didn't sit well with me. And so as I watch Mark and Nippy and Sarah, really their first, I think, action was around stopping this. You know, again, this is like, no, this is, I'm awake. This can't happen anymore. This has to stop. So the energy was followed there. And now I'm like, where are you guys? I'm so interested to know, like, what's your process right now? How are you healing from participating in something like this?
That's why I'm a little bit concerned for them with the success of this show. Kind of like what you're saying, Piper, it felt to me like Seduced was really from the point of view of, like, yeah, a participant and India's journey through that, whereas The Vow, it's definitely told through their point of view, where I feel like they're framed. I mean, I wouldn't say they're totally painting themselves as heroes. Like, I feel like there's obviously remorse, there's regret. We see them start to process their participation in this. But I'm also aware there's a way in which they've, perhaps very smartly and savvily, turned it into a vehicle also for their own success with HBO and now sort of being like the righteous crusaders against the evil Keith. And just speaking to what you were saying, Anne, my own sort of intuitive sense of someone like Mark watching it was like, you don't really want to look at the part of you that fully went along with this. It just felt to me with Mark like it's easier for you to just see Keith as the bad guy, to see him as the harbinger of evil, than it is to really know fully what part of you got hooked into being made special. I mean, it also reminds me of that moment. I think this was in The Vow, I think, where Catherine Oxenberg was sort of laughing about that moment where, I guess, something about Bonnie being in the dog bed and she had been sleeping there as penance. And, you know, Mark got really triggered by that. And he sort of turned it into like, I'm taking a stand for Bonnie's trauma and how serious this is. And the way that landed with me was just, you don't want to look at the part of you that took pleasure in her penance, that took pleasure in that power dynamic. And again, kind of going back to what we were saying earlier, for someone like Mark and Sarah, are you able, and I think this is the work of all of us and wherever we are in our lives, cult or not, to like take a full hard look and to take full responsibility for your own lower self, meaning the part of you that you absolutely got something out of this, that took pleasure in it in a way that doesn't feel good now that you're bringing it into consciousness, and also still hold space for your own goodness and your own good intentions? Because it just feels to me like that's where the true healing will happen. And, you know, I think for someone like Mark, I just get this sort of inner conflict around, like, if I let myself fully know how easily I was seduced into this and where this took me, that, again, it means I'm bad. It means I'm wrong. It means I'm one of the evil people. And again, it's just sort of easier to look at Keith as the evil one and for me to sort of be the victim than to rather sort of go all the way with like the full awareness and consciousness of my own participation, my own lower self, which I think, you know, to what you're saying, Anne, is where the true healing would actually occur for him.
Yeah. And I might even say it a little bit differently, because lower self is a frame that has a certain expectation of what people are doing and why they're doing it. Whatever is there, and I don't know if it was all pleasure or what it was, right? But whatever is there that allows us to go along with things that are wrong, you know, or not see things, there's something that's, you know, very challenging about opening our eyes to ways that we have, I mean, I even think about being like in a very privileged position in this society and like all the ways that it served me for many years not to see, not to know, not to really not see. And I think there's something about when we start to see the ways we participated and really go into the nitty-gritty of what did I get out of that and why did I do it. And it's, I think, a challenge to hold ourselves. And for me, this is the whole point of what we're talking about. We're human beings. All human beings do this. It's not like we're special, you know. This is just part of the human condition. And how do we grow up here? Mm-hmm. And how do we as healers help hold people so that they are able to see and feel and stay with themselves all the way through to an ownership of themselves in ways that will allow them to go out in the world differently when they go all the way through the process. And I did have that feeling about Mark that, wow, I would so want to support him in really understanding what happened there. Like, what were all the intricacies of how you ended up in that position? And what will you have to see and feel about yourself, your past, your family of origin, your, you know, human foibles? You know, what will you have to see and feel to really come all the way through this in a way that will truly make your ability to change this kind of system in the world really powerful? Because what you've done is great, but like you can go so much further if you feel all this stuff inside yourself, your voice, your authority, your ability to speak to the whole thing will be just much more powerful and complex.
You know what I thought was interesting? What, at least part of what I saw had something to do in both Sarah and Mark's sort of awakening. It took the people that they trusted and cared about to be able to help them see something outside of the dynamic that they were in with Keith, because people had been leaving before Bonnie. They were part of making the people that were leaving bad and against something that was good. And then when Bonnie woke up and the conversations that were taped between he and her, where she was sort of saying, I have to do this, you know, this is, I'm awake, I can't unsee what I've seen, I just, you know, this is it. And he was still like, yeah, and he's my friend, and I'm getting something from this. And, you know, there was some way that he was in conflict, I think, with what you're saying, Anne. Like, I think he was kind of aware that he was in a position where he, his whole life in Sarah also, they had a center. Their whole livelihood was tied up in this as well. This wasn't a spiritual movement. This wasn't something, you know, it was like totally embedded in their whole lifestyle, their whole way of being. And they were being confronted by a person that they loved and cared about that was saying there is something intrinsically dangerous and wrong about what you are participating in. And it was almost like I could feel the desire to separate there, you know, to separate from her experience and his experience. Okay, well, yeah, you were having this experience over here and it's separate than mine, even though I'm participating in the experience that you're having. There was something about listening to that sort of reckoning, the thing that you start to wake up to and the things that we cling to that would maybe help us to stay separate from our participation.
And I was thinking what you're saying, Piper. I think a person like Bonnie, first of all, that I don't think people understand what power their voice has, even if you don't recognize it. Mm-hmm. Like, even if it takes a while, Bonnie opened a doorway in that system. Just by doing what she did, she opened a doorway. And like, once a doorway gets opened, more can go through. Like, just takes one person to have the courage. And, or that woman, I can't remember, the woman who did it first. But mm-hmm. I think what's interesting about what you're saying is that Bonnie and Catherine Oxenberg stayed connected to the people inside. They didn't like cut them off. They stayed loving. They stayed connected. And there's something about that staying connected and still standing in your truth that I think really allowed something different to happen than if Bonnie had just said, "You're insane and I'm divorcing you," or "You fuck you." She didn't. She stayed very connected to herself and to them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really powerful thing that she did, which allowed, you know, slowly over time for them to start opening their eyes.
And I think in that, I would name that as such a self-responsible thing to do. And part of what I think is something that she maybe already had somehow, or, you know, like she came into this in some way, like the things that she was attracted to, the things that she followed always sort of rang true to her, like the, at least the way they depicted. That's what I saw anyway with the footage that was offered. It was like something in her allowed her to say, "Yep, this is what I did." And I took that information and I actually really took it all the way through in a way that allowed me to see something. Like, and this is where I think not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? Like, there's something really good here about what they were offering. Like, she actually was doing work that helped her look at, okay, if this is true, I can also challenge this leader. Yeah. I can say, look what you're, you know, look at what's happening here. And then to keep getting met with the same thing, that something was wrong with her, it was like, no. I've integrated this material inside me enough to know that what you're saying doesn't fit for me.
Yeah.
And you are now limiting me.
And that's separating the material from the leader.
Exactly.
And I think that's also really important. Mm. That the work that people are doing hopefully empowers them, exactly what you're saying. I mean, that happened for me in the work I did. The work got separated from the leader. And the work in and of itself gave me the strength to be able to say, "This isn't good. I'm leaving," you know?
And create something that allows yourself to be challenged in that, you know? Yeah. That's why I've stayed all along, is because what I have brought to you has been received and things have changed. And not just what I brought, but I've seen the things that have come into this system get heard and then responded to.
Not always right away and not always easily. Like, mm-hmm. So just to be clear, right? Like, it's a struggle and a commitment for everyone all around.
And just to be clear, we're talking here now about radical aliveness. You're saying, Piper, you're saying you've stayed all along because of your experience of things being received and heard rather than turned away.
And like Anne said, sorry, not right away, you know, where somebody else might see things the same because they left and they're not in contact anymore with the changes that are trying to be made or grappled with or, you know, really wrestled with. It's like some people choose to leave. When people leave and they leave with an image or an experience, and then they're holding that image and experience as if that's still happening, it doesn't give a chance for a system also to change and to grow. And then to, again, point fingers at and say, "Don't go to this place. Don't go to this thing, because this is a cult or this is a thing that is bad or wrong," instead of, "This wasn't a good fit for me."
And what I love about kind of what you were saying, Piper, in terms of Anne's journey, well, first of all, just this whole notion of separating the work from the leader feels so powerful. I'm actually in the process of just doing a little education for myself of like learning more about the history of the world and the, you know, the origins of religion. For whatever reason, I just feel compelled lately to have a deeper, more specific sense of context for the time that we're in. And, you know, it's interesting because I feel like in so many ways, as I'm reading about, you know, the origins of, you know, the three, let's call them the three big religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, it's like that very thing, the blurred line between the leader and the work. I mean, you can really trace so many of the early divisions and the wars that erupted between the different divisions to that very thing. It's like placing the leader as more of a god or more powerful than the work itself. So that just felt very powerful to me to just kind of very clearly name that. But also in terms of like, Anne, your journey of being willing to separate the leader from the work and being willing to experience the pain of the disconnection, because that's a big part of what we brought in from the beginning. It's like, if you're willing to speak up and you're in a cult-like environment, you have to be willing to experience the pain of disconnection, which goes against perhaps the very impulse, or one of the very impulses, that was drawing you to the program in the first place, which was a desire for community and connection. But what I wanted to say about that, again, like in this conversation around principles of energy is what I would call it. If everything's sort of a hologram within a hologram, and my whole life is a reflection in some way of my relationship with myself, it stands to reason then that if I'm willing to stay connected to myself and to my truth, yes, that might mean a temporary painful disconnection from the community that's right in front of me. But on the other side of that, by virtue of my willingness to stay in deep connection with myself, there's actually the opportunity perhaps for even deeper connection reflected in the world. And I feel like in this case, like, had you not left the community you were in, more than likely you wouldn't have created what you're creating now, or at least not in the same way.
Oh, and, no.
Yeah. So just to really illustrate, like, your willingness to honor the connection within yourself, even if that meant disconnection from those around you, still brought you into deeper connection, I think, well, with yourself and also the world on the other side.
And I would say, just to be really clear, like, because we're talking about how do we change systems? How do we have influence in our world? That for me, I was so fortunate that in my process of my, I identify with Mark, you know, I'll just say, like, for me, I might as well have been Mark, you know, the person who was special and who wasn't seeing things and who was going along with things that were, you know, not good. And I tried my best to see the goodness along with the things that weren't working. And I think that process allowed, and gratitude for what I got, gratitude for the goodness of what I got. And I think that, you know, we're talking about what is it that allows us that to then go out in the world kind of changed in a way that maybe generates something different to happen.
It sounds like what you're saying, at least in this case or in this one instance, you know, for someone like Mark, like, yeah, absolutely, the willingness to really look at where this took him and why, both without making himself bad or wrong for it, and also, yeah, really willing to be honest and unflinching in it, would take him to that deeper level of understanding so that he's not, yeah, in resistance to parts of himself, certainly, and in that way, not in a binary frame of mind, which does want to paint things as all good, all bad, all right or wrong. And how that really does extend both to institutions outside of us, whether it's like Keith or Neary or Republicans, or, and also to how we hold ourselves and the parts of us that we think are good and the parts of us that we think are bad and the parts of us that we think are right and the parts of us that we think are wrong. And if we do kind of hold the very, like, if we undertake the very process we're talking about for ourselves, are we willing to slow down with ourselves, surrender into our own field, and really just get curious about the different parts of ourselves, the wisdom that lives in the different parts of ourselves, without defaulting into judgment that wants to just kind of stomp out, you know, certain parts of ourselves while also taking responsibility for our impact. If we have, you know, if we've made decisions that have impacted others and hurt others and caused destruction, the willingness to take responsibility for that and to feel that and to own it, and also to understand our own humanity at the same time.
One of the things that I was interested in had something to do with the money, the way that they were funded and how that money allowed them in some ways to maintain their position, because people did try to leave before Bonnie and they were sued. He made it really hard for people to leave. And what was that about? Well, it's like Trump. I mean, to me, I like feel Trump here. There's such a deep streak of, call it narcissism. I don't know what to call it.
I'm bully. Really.
Yeah, it's a way the power, his own power, was held. If somebody says that, thanks, no thanks, I'm out. And by the way, you know, this is what this is going to mean for you. It was like he doubled down. It was like, no, I'm going to destroy you. It was like a personal, maybe this is it. He was not separate from the work.
He evidently didn't do the work.
Yeah,
because he wasn't very developed in that way. What I think is interesting is if you look at politics in the United States of America, everybody who's at the highest level of politics has a ton of money behind them. Everyone, no matter where you're at. And what would happen if people actually had to earn their positions of power from, I don't know, you know, I don't know how you would change this system. But I think it's really interesting that thing that you're saying about people couldn't leave, that there was a place in Keith, or a place that it looks like for me with Trump, that doesn't have trust in his own goodness. So if something is said about you that in any way shakes you internally, you have to kill. You know, you have to kill the voices, you have to kill the dissenters. And this is what we've been talking about this whole time. What does it take to support human beings to have the strength to be able to be challenged or not need to be in total control of the narrative, really be in service of something larger and be out of control? Be out of control. And how hard that is.
Well, what I also find fascinating about Keith Raniere, and this really came up for me during Seduced, was what was the end game here? Because really, I mean, he was playing like a pretty sloppy game. I mean, as kind of broken down and seduced, I mean, he basically was starting to amass these several tiers of sex slaves. And if I'm remembering correctly, kind of had a vision of how large it was going to grow. Again, it's sort of like before, it was the childlike absurdity of the end goal of this is we're all going to be in constant joy all the time. There's something that feels almost so, yes, childlike about this vision of this vast empire of sex slaves and the idea that this is never going to come to light. You know, no one's ever going to find out about it. And then,
even though I'm having you film absolutely everything I'm saying and doing while I do it.
Well, that's what I was about to say. And then I could not believe this. That moment where India discovers that audio file. I mean, it was literally like out of a movie, that there's audio of him literally walking through making this tattoo and this brand and what it means. And I'm just sort of watching the TV being like, God, for a persuasive guy who managed to like create this powerful cult, there's something that's just so, I just keep coming back to the word childlike, banal, almost like dumb about this whole thing. And it does make me really curious. Like I said, like, what was this guy's endgame? And just even that kind of, I don't know if I'd call it duality of like this sort of sophisticated thinker who created this organization that had a lot of energy and a lot of power in it. And at the same time, he just feels like this little boy, literally calling himself Vanguard. I think that was a reference to like a video game. Like that's like almost the energy of this. It's like a little boy playing a video game.
Well, talk about being seduced. Keith Raniere was seduced. You know, he was seduced and seduced by people telling him that he was all powerful and him swallowing that whole. Yeah. And let's just say that if you are in a position of power and you cannot be challenged, it's going to end badly, right? Because how does a leader grow? How does a leader grow up? How does Trump grow up if no one can challenge him? How does Keith Raniere grow up if all he's surrounded by are people telling him that he's the most brilliant person on planet Earth? People forget they're human beings when they get seduced by power, I think.
I mean, that's kind of the hit that I just got, actually, as you started to speak. The voice that I heard just kind of said there was no end game. Like, when you take into kind of the full context, like his background before Nexium of creating that, whatever that sort of MLM, he created some sort of pyramid scheme con, you know, and then that got undermined, and then I guess he met Nancy soon thereafter, and then they built this thing, and it's almost like the vibe I get off of it is just sort of this guy just kind of had this, I mean, talk about again, like, yeah, the energy of smashing and destruction. It almost just feels like there's this force of will, and it's almost kind of like he wants what he wants in the moment, and it does to me. It feels like this forceful energy that's just going to keep moving for the sake of moving. And I don't even experience it as having like a higher designer end game. It's just like, I want what I want and I want it now. And this is what I want. And I kind of have some information. I have some intelligence and some persuasion. And this is what I'm doing in the moment. And this is what I'm doing in the moment. And this is what I'm doing in the moment. And that's
seduced by power made him dumb. Mm-hmm. Like seduced by power made him really dumb. I don't even know if they were his ideas. It seems to me they were Nancy's.
The money wasn't his. Nothing was his aside from the ability to amass brilliant, successful, driven beings around him to do something for him. Sad a little bit. I didn't feel his charisma. Like I didn't feel his heart. That's what I would say. There was nothing attractive about him for me as a person. He's not somebody that would have ever been able to seduce me into giving a dollar to. So I was like, okay, well, what's that about? What was it? What was his promise, if you want to call it an end game? He spoke it in ways, I want to change the world. That's what he said. I want people to be able to change the world with their limitless ideas and thinking. And so was that what he felt like he was doing through other people and then kind of got lost in some other blip that he had? But the scenes with him playing the piano, that he knows three songs, just that in itself, learning music to say, look at how good I can play three songs. Or I don't know, there's something about the way he even did things before he did Nexium, where it was like about the end game and something about that not being embodied in a process, the idea or even the imagination of what was happening for him in these, you know, sexual encounters. I can't even really kind of let myself drop into that for some reason, because it almost feels like even the pleasure of maybe what was happening had nothing to do with the physical sensation, but the power of getting somebody to do what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know what they're doing.
Totally. I mean, I remember dropping in a bit to him when I was watching it, and it really was. It was, it's the same energy that I feel, and I want to be clear, I don't fully drop into like serial killers, but I'll start to kind of let myself feel, you know, if I watch a movie about Jeffrey Dahmer or something. And it was the exact same flavor of like, oh God, sorry, I'm starting to feel it. But it's this flavor of like what you're saying. It's power, control, and it's like, I just keep hearing the word torture. It's like exacting. There's such like a pleasure in the exacting nature of the control and like drawing it out. And I can feel there is such an like an erotic charge there too. But yeah, I think it's absolutely, because I mean, I think India even described some of the sexual encounters and they were like strange and sort of passive. It was sort of almost like an artifice of sexuality. And it does very much feel about this sort of deep, torturous, not for him, but this sort of pleasure of inflicting a kind of torture on others and how exacting it is and just the control and the power that he has there.
Yeah, he felt so creepy to me and I couldn't understand why people were attracted to him. It just seemed so creepy. But I was thinking about, at some point we talked about the mainstream and this good, bad, right, wrong, and the people who are the anti-cult people. I also think that there was something he was trying to do that was outside of the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And that there's something about pushing up against the mainstream and the way the mainstream comes back at you if you try and go outside of the norms of what people are saying are the right way to do things. That in some ways, there's a lack of tolerance, I find, in the mainstream sometimes, or out-of-the-box ways of thinking or being that want to make it bad or wrong. And then how, if you have those ideas, or if you're trying to stand for them, how much you have to gird yourself or protect yourself to keep bringing that vision forth. And I think something about that in connection with the flaws in his personality was just deadly. Mm-hmm. Because if you're protecting yourself, saying, you know, I'm standing for these ideas, and then somehow people are handing you all this power, telling you you're invincible, it's a deadly, deadly combination.
Do you guys think that he believed in his own stated good intentions? Like, what is your take on his level of conscious awareness of using this program to control and exploit others in a way that was deceptive?
I don't feel like I got to see enough to know. Did it start in a certain way, and as he got more power, he became more and more crazy? Because I think that happens. It's like, even if I look at Trump, people would not challenge him. You know, there was no way to challenge him without losing your political career, without, you know, without losing all the stuff that you've spent a lifetime trying to build. And so what happens when people are given more and more power and not challenged? I don't know if he started out more believing in what he was doing and then went more and more crazy. I don't know. What do you think, Piper?
What was shown was footage along the way, because there was so much footage. And I did seem to track a level of change in him.
Me too.
And that's kind of like what I was saying, like the way that it was done, it wasn't clear like what was happening when and how. And but watching him in the footage, like you can tell when he's younger, you know, you can see his aging. So I could kind of put a timeline in there. And that in the beginning, there seemed to be an enthusiasm for what he was actually offering that was, you know, powerful. Like I could feel that there was something really potentially supportive or helpful in that. And then I have this sense that something happened as he started to amass more people imbibing him with power and making him special, kind of feeding that deeper split that was there all along. And rather than him maybe doing work around that in his own, using his own
technology. What,
yeah. Was Nancy doing EMs for him?
Like,
you know, right? Like that's where, you know, that would be another thing that I would say to anybody listening. If you are learning from anybody who is not involved in learning more, that they are on a path where they've learned everything they need to learn and their only goal is to teach you what they know, I would question who you're learning from. I would just ask yourself, is the information that I'm getting helpful for me? Is it relative to my experience now? Because for me personally, I value being a learner from someone who is continuing to evolve. If you're questioning whether or not the environment that you're learning in is good for you, a good question to ask yourself is, who are you learning alongside and with? And are they doing the work that they're teaching?
Well, let me throw one last question out there. I feel like just to kind of maybe bring everything full circle. in that place where we kind of talked about like the cult experts and also the people on the cult site who are just basically like cults bad, everything to do with them bad, you know, teachings bad. What do you think those people would have to tolerate if they were willing to get more curious about, you know, some of the principles or teachings that are underneath the seeds of these cults?
Fear. What are you afraid of?
What do you think they are? I mean, I know there's not one answer, but I'm just curious about it as an energy. It's like, if I'm someone who's just sort of like, I'm on this cult website and I take people out of cults and cults are evil, and it's like, I'm just trying to feel into that. What am I afraid of if I open up to the idea these aren't just hapless victims who got sucked into a mumbo jumbo that was only designed to like exploit and abuse them?
That it could happen to me. I'm no different.
Yeah, it's like, I guess as them, it, to me, it's like the world suddenly feels dangerous. Yeah, I guess it's similar to what you're saying. Like, I could get seduced into something. And where's the safeguard?
Yeah, and it feels a little bit like they're such crusaders, right? It's like, I am doing good and helping all these people. And not to say that people don't get victimized, absolutely. And not to say that there aren't bad organizations or terrible things happening in the world. But we keep talking about, what does it take in ourselves to see other human beings as, I feel like they would have to see the world as more complex. They would have to see themselves as smaller than they think they are, and they would have to see the people involved in cults as bigger than they are. You know, like, how do we recognize people's power and how do we support it?
Well, I think there's also something about discomfort here, because if people are invested in comfort, there's an investment also in not seeing, not knowing what's going on around their nest of comfort. And people that maybe step into, like, what go full circle, like, what is it that draws someone to an organization that has sort of expansive information? There's a level of discomfort that I've been sitting with, and I'm seeking more information about how to either live with that discomfort or to shift it and change it. And if I'm not that person, I'm then looking, what are you so uncomfortable around? Like, what's wrong with you that you're not comfortable with this environment that we're both sitting in? I'm going to other you and say that your discomfort is a dysfunction. And the reason you went to a dysfunctional, maybe community has something to do with you're looking for something that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And that comes from my lack of willingness to feel any aspect of discomfort. And whether that's because of my privilege, whether that's because of my strong, rigid way of not feeling anything outside of my own experience that would threaten that or rattle that just a little bit. If you're sitting on the fence and saying, I would never do that, what is it that you're saying you would never do? You would never seek something new, or you would never seek it in that way? What is it that you're saying?
Well, and then it does in a way become part of like the self-fulfilling cycle, because, and it's like what you were saying, Anne, about the mainstream rejecting or fighting against, you know, alternative ways. It's like, well, then that creates a culture where it's hard to, you know, for people who are seekers, it's hard to find places to seek and to explore. And so when these communities pop up, you know, that's part of what makes it enticing. And if we did live in a world that were more open towards things that are outside the mainstream and like curiosity and exploration and sort of seeing what's behind door number 1, 2, 3, and 4, then cults wouldn't have as much appeal or power, because they wouldn't really be, I mean, not that they are actually the only resource, but they wouldn't feel like, you know, one of the only resources for people who are looking for something more.
And it wouldn't be so less underground, you know, more, it would be less underground.
And there's something about, like, when I think about the mainstream and the intention, right? The intention of Rick Ross or these people is around safety, right? Or the intention of the rules, the intention of the the norms, the intention that says this is how it has to be to protect people and keep them safe. There's some truth in that, and that's good, but it also keeps a frame around things that sees human beings as less powerful than they are, and that doesn't require the leaders or whoever are holding, or all of us who are here to be with other people, to learn how to be in support of true empowerment and what that requires from me as a leader, and the, what that requires me to see about human beings. It's just easier if I feel like I'm the savior and I can make rules, and then we never have to face any difficult situations where we all have to, yeah, like Piper's saying, sit with the discomfort. And I'm a big believer that human beings are incredibly powerful. And if we weren't powerful, we would not be alive today, because people have gone through hell for centuries and they're thriving and creative and alive. So I think the idea that human beings aren't capable of handling life and need all these rules to make them safe, it does a disservice to the human spirit. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have, I think we should have rules and agreements, but they should be rules and agreements that allow the humans participating in the system to have some agency.
Yeah, and it's just interesting that we're just sort of coming back to, I think, one of the original topics, which is like disowned power, you know, and kind of what feels like a cultural collusion to disown power, which I think in a lot of ways comes from, yeah, reluctance to take responsibility for my own power and sort of where that takes me. And so I just think that's a really sort of fertile and interesting thing for all of us to be contemplating, like, what would it truly mean for me to take responsibility for my own power, and where does that take me, you know, and how would the world change if we all were willing to contemplate that?
What does power even mean, and what does it look like in different cultures, and what does responsibility look like across cultures and across differences? And I think it means different things wherever you are.
You know, there's just so much here in the conversation around self-responsibility for recognizing what, like Anne was saying, what does power even mean to me as a person? And then how do I see it play out in my small little circles? And then how do I listen and hear it play out in the world?
How do we make things visible so they can be challenged?
Yes. Make room for voices.
All right. We've explored a lot. I feel like, let's see if there are concluding thoughts. I know for me, just the one thing that kind of keeps circling around my head as I kind of just drop back into the nexium of it all, you know, and you hear this all the time, like in any kind of story of someone who ends up, like, you know, kind of feeling betrayed or abused by a guru. It's like those places where people ignore warning signs inside themselves or red flags inside themselves or the voice that says, wait, this doesn't feel right or good. And I guess, you know, just on a fundamental level, especially, you know, I mean, we all work with clients, but certainly for me, like in my work with clients, it's like, I just want to stress the importance of never discounting that voice and just sort of seeing and hearing and feeling all the different ways I think all of us, you know, have for coming up with reasons and excuses, like why we discount that voice, and how much would be different if people didn't discount that voice. And I think just in terms of like the conversation we just had, to really kind of own the voice that says, like, no, that hesitation in you, that red flag in you, that impulse to slow down or to check something out, that is a powerful impulse. And that is a part of what I would call your power, my power, our power. And just to really at least check it out if you find yourself talking yourself out of it, dismissing it, or explaining it away, and really kind of being rigorous around why are you explaining it away? And why are you coming up with reasons to ignore it? And what might it mean if you didn't?
I think my final thought has to do with just saying really clearly that leaders are human beings. and nobody is like, we're all human beings, and that any place you're not willing to see a leader as a human being, whatever you have to feel inside yourself, and I think that goes along with what you're saying, Jamie, the places we explain away our misgivings or our questions, I feel like there's something people have to give up, you know, around wishing for this power outside of themselves to have answers, and just to say, give it up. Like, not that you can't get support or help or that there's not a lot of beautiful stuff out there, but to really feel your own power and to understand that leaders are just human beings. And if you start thinking of them as more than you or better than you or having powers that you don't have, I really want you to challenge yourself, because it's not the truth.
Or even the need or demand that you might have on leaders to be perfect. And if they make a mistake or have their humanity, somehow, you know, they've fallen in your eyes. And I think that's something for people to really kind of look at inside themselves. Because again, that's the culture that creates cults. It's the place in us where we're willing, we want someone, like you said, outside of ourselves to be some perfect embodiment of whatever the work is. And to know that's never going to exist. And you're not in reality if you're looking for that, and you're setting yourself up for some sort of abusive power in that place.
Yeah.
What a time to be alive at this particular time, you know, with everything that's going on. What a time to be alive and to wake up to this life that we're living, and to continue to strive, I guess, in some way to live it in a way that makes sense for each of us. And whether we surround ourselves with leaders or teachers or communities that support us in a certain way, what a time to really ask what does support life becoming and evolving and moving, because it keeps going, you know, it always keeps going. So how are we in rhythm with it? And I think these kind of like documentaries that are out there right now that kind of get deposited into our consciousness to ask us, all right, how do we see leadership? How do we see self-responsibility? Who do I seek to teach me the next step? And what do I allow myself to know about who I'm in relationship with and the impact that not only they have on me, but I have in that exchange? I feel really fortunate to have, you know, both of you to kind of reflect and bounce things off with all the time. Because for me, I want to really surround myself with people that are doing their inquiry, their work. And how lucky are we to have all this information coming all the time to go, all right, here's another thing to look at. I mean, who would have thought that Nexium would be entry point for this?
Yeah.
All right. My final note is I feel hopeful when you talk about the time we're in. I just say that because, you know, there's so much unfolding, and I feel like it almost feels cool right now, at least on social media, to like talk about like 2020 and how horrible it's been and what a dumpster fire it's been and how tough these times are. And I always just kind of look at that. I'm like, it's interesting. It's an interesting narrative that's being written. And, you know, or even when we have conversations like this that hold the complexity, and I feel like are offering an invitation for the collective to hold the complexity. And then, of course, you feel like what we're up against, right? Because that's not necessarily the reality right now. I just know there's often a temptation, I think I see here and feel, to kind of be like, oh, it's hopeless. But I just want to say, I don't actually feel that it's hopeless. And I feel like, again, in the energy of creation, like even this one conversation, like this is something that is going to be out there, you know? And so this conversation has its own energy. And I feel something is building, and I feel, yeah, there's a momentum in consciousness. And I really do have hope for where this is all headed.
Yeah, I loved having this conversation. Thank you. I mean, it's like, oh, it's so, so interesting. And I was thinking about what I just said, you know, kind of saying it in a negative way about don't see leaders as better than you. So I want to end on a positive note of how do you become a value added? Because I think we're all here to be a value added to life. And if we really own our power, or see ourselves in right relationship as human beings to every other human being, I think we can really be a value added to life. And that's what I want to do.
Piper, and thank you so much for being here. I feel like you're both so just tremendously wise, gifted, brilliant. And I always kind of, I always feel a little bit like, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with this. I feel like the elementary school kid at the table, but I get so much and I learn so much just from kind of being in your individual and collective fields. That said, where can people find you guys if they want, you know, if they're curious about your work, if they want to know more, where should they kind of seek you out?
I'm in deep, Heidi.
I am too. Like, I'm not sure where you can find, an old version of the website on Radical Aliveness Institute, and you can read some stuff, but I feel like this past year has been a time of deep change, and what we're going to be and who we are is not the same as what's out there right now. So you can find out some stuff, but we're in transformation.
Well, I'll just say then, and they can also follow you on Instagram, Radical Aliveness, because you are in transformation and transition, but maybe people just want to kind of keep tabs for when you're emerging from the cocoon, because it is a powerful program. It's powerful work. And also, I mean, not right now, but presumably when life opens up a bit more and facilitates really powerful workshops at institutes like Esalen in California and Hollyhock in Canada, and there's another one, right?
Omega
in New York. So again, who knows what's going to happen in the future, but that's been the past. And actually, Piper and I both have often assisted Anne, and perhaps that will happen again in the future at these 5-day workshops. So go to radicalaliveness.org. Is that the website? Radical Aliveness on Instagram. I guess Piper's in hiding, so I won't force the issue. And as always, you can follow me on Instagram, Jamie Stein, JAMIESTEIN. You can go to my website, hollywoodreadings.com, if you're interested in a reading. And we will be back later for some more deep dives into pop culture and what's going on in the world around us. Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Piper.
Thanks, you guys. It was great.
Thank you both. Had a fun time. Thank you.
You too.
Bye.